This is React Podcast. I'm Chantastic. This week on React Podcast, we sit down with Chance Strickland, better known as Chance the Dev, to talk about Reach UI and building flexible, composable, open source libraries. We tackle the topics of accessibility, state charts, TypeScript, unopinionated styling, library packaging, and the career effects of great open source work. Before we dive in, I want to tell you about today's sponsor, Infinite Red. If you're building a React or React Native app and you're feeling stuck, check out Infinite Red. They'll come alongside you and get you back into a groove with your React or React Native project. They've taught tens of thousands of developers through open source and their annual React Native conference, Chain React. Start or refer a new project today and get two free tickets to Chain React Conf in 2021. Get started at reactpodcast.infinite.red and build a beautiful functional app today. Chance Strickland, welcome to React Podcast.
Thanks, man. Thanks for having me.
It's good to have you. You moved to my town. You called me up. We got coffee one time. I was ridiculously late. I still feel bad about that. I'm sorry.
It's okay.
But how are you liking San Diego?
I love it here, man. It's such a great town. I just for the listeners, I moved from Nashville, Tennessee. I'm originally from Atlanta, Georgia, and so this is my first time not living in the South. And I, you know, still have a soft spot for the South and miss the comfort food from time to time. But San Diego it's always sort of like, ever since I first visited here, I felt like some like magnetic attraction to this town. Like it's so. Like the speed, the pace, the culture, the vibe, the weather, just you're so close to anything in the outdoors that you might want to do at all times. And it's always nice enough to do whatever you want to do outside. So it's just, I don't know. It's great. And I love it. Yeah. Having a great time.
It's pretty great too. Cause like, you know, let's say you don't want perfect weather just for a hot second,
just leave.
You're only about an hour and a half from like the desert or the mountains or like whatever you want.
I never understand. Everyone's like, oh, don't you miss seasons? I'm like, the seasons are really close. I just go somewhere else that has them. And the good seasons are only 2 weeks long anyway in the South. Like fall is amazing. I love fall, but it's over in 2 weeks. You go from like disgusting summer to like sort of fall to like, nope. We joked on you, like it's actually still summer, to like sort of fall, but also like rainy all the time, to now it's just freezing. And so like, who wants that sort of like tumultuous day to day? Like I just like waking up in the morning, going outside in like a light sweatshirt and walking my dog. And that's what you do here.
Now you mentioned the pace. Like what is it? I've my whole life have lived here. So I'm kind of curious, like, you know, coming from, you know, from Nashville, like what is the, what's the pace? Or like Tennessee, sorry.
Yeah, so Nashville's actually from just a cultural, like business pace kind of perspective, it's not that different. I actually really liked living in Nashville a lot as well for that reason. But what I really like, so I like to compare it more to like New York or LA, LA specifically because they're both Southern California. But in LA, there's always like everyone's always moving. And when you interact with folks who are especially in like entrepreneur kind of like situations, meetups, and different sort of like networking events and everything, when you encounter people in the business space, especially, people are always like ready to move on. Like they're in a hurry. They want to like get somewhere. They want to, you know, a nice like wrapped up conclusion to every discussion. They want everything to be like positioned to move you into a certain destination. Whereas I feel like here you can just sort of go to a networking meet, which is exactly what I did, by the way, shortly after I moved here. You know, I connected with you. I connected with Michael Jackson, like some of the folks I knew who lived in the area, just from online. But I also started going to these meetups. I was freelancing at the time, so I would go to these freelancer meetups, these entrepreneur meetups, and people were just like having conversations, like normal people, you know. And it's sort of like the difference between LinkedIn and Twitter. You know, like LinkedIn feels like this really stuffy place where everyone has a motive. Whereas Twitter, people are just being humans, right? Like I think San Diego is Twitter and LA is LinkedIn, you know, but like it's a cooler LinkedIn than maybe, I don't know, you know, New York or Singapore or something. I don't know. It's just like, it's not as stuffy in LA, but it still sort of like has that, I don't know how to describe it other than that, but
Yeah, people are chasing some kind of outcome, maybe, exactly. Instead of just being in the moment.
Yeah, and I think people here are just, no matter what their end goal is, they're still happy to like connect. It's very similar to the South in a lot of ways.
Yeah, I love that. So you're awesome. And one of the reasons that I wanted to have you on the show is because you maintain one of build and maintain one of my favorite React projects. And I kind of wanted to just discuss with you Reach UI as, I guess, like a lens into what it takes to build a flexible and competent React UI library. And I know that, you know, Reach is like fairly focused, on accessibility, but I think that it gives us a lot of, like a really good lens into kind of modern requirements for like a flexible UI tool. But first, before all that, just tell me a little bit about Reach, like what the goal is, like what you've been working on the last, year or so.
Yeah, so Reach UI, for anyone who's not familiar with it, it's a component library. It's been around for a few years. It was initially created by Ryan Florence. And, at sort of its simplest level, Ryan wrote up this really great philosophy document on Reach UI that I think does a really great job of explaining this in detail. But at a very high level, the three pillars that I think of when I think of Reach, I think of accessibility, having useful abstractions, and composition. Those are sort of the three guiding principles that I think of when I'm building a new Reach component or when I'm considering making any sort of feature additions to Reach UI. It's important to note, too, that unlike a lot of other component libraries, Reach UI is intentionally low level in terms of opinions about presentation, style. We don't do very much at all to style any of our components because the idea behind Reach is that we are providing you a foundational set of elements to create design systems with, and you might have any number of ways that you approach styling in your design system, and we don't want to interfere with that. We want to work seamlessly with that. So if you use styled components, great, you style components. If you use CSS, use CSS. If you want to use SAS modules, use SAS modules. It doesn't really matter to us. We give you enough to make our components usable by default, and then you even have the ability to opt out of that but just not import our CSS and nothing happens and, you can do whatever you want with it. But yeah, that being unopinionated about style and presentation, plus those three pillars of accessibility, having useful abstractions and composition, I think are ultimately what Reach boils down to in terms of our approach.
Yeah, I love that. Now, I think what is it that sets Reach apart? If I'm not mistaken, Reach has kind of been around for maybe 2-ish years now in some form.
Yeah. And I would say that Reach, when it first was released, Ryan has this really amazing gift for seeing things down the road that I think a lot of other folks don't necessarily see coming. It's really awesome to just have the opportunity to sit and listen to him think. He will just think out loud in a call from time to time. And it's like, you were like 10 steps ahead of where I was in terms of whatever the conversation is. Right. And so being able to work with him on Reach was awesome because you get to experience that firsthand and learn a lot from that. But I like to imagine where his head was when Reach started was sort of different from where it is today, because so many existing component libraries have adopted a lot of our approaches in Reach. Ever since it came out, it's been a model there for others to grab at and sort of take inspiration from when they're building their own component libraries. So I would say what sets Reach apart today is different than what set Reach apart when it first was released and when he started building his initial components for Reach, and where Reach will be in the next year, 2 years, 3 years, and how it stands apart then, I think is yet to be determined because we have to see where the community takes us. But at this point in time, I think Reach is still different because we don't give you anything in terms of presentation, whereas a lot of libraries have some opinions about how you go about doing things, right? And that's not always a bad thing. It just sort of depends on what your need is.
Sure.
If you're developing a design system from scratch, you want a sort of more bare bones thing that you can, throw your whimsy at, right? But if you want to build a product very quickly and get it to market and you don't have the time and energy to go and style everything, then maybe another library is better suited for those tasks. We're not trying to be that kind of library,
I love throw your whimsy.
I'll market that.
That's good stuff.
One other thing before I forget about it that I do think sets us apart, aside from just presentational differences, is our approach to managing state. We give folks the option to manage state themselves, just like a controlled and uncontrolled input in React, right? Like you have the option to let the browser handle it, or you can go and handle it yourself. You know, we have a similar approach to most of our components, but you know, we do a lot of work behind the scenes to make sure those interactions are seamless. And one of the things that we've adopted relatively recently is state charts, and specifically using the XState FSM library that David Corsi developed and built. It's a great library, but more important than the library is this whole like idea of thinking in state charts. And just adopting that model for state management in the library has exposed so many nuances for all of these components. The most recent one on my mind is the one that I most recently built. It's the list box, or what we think of as a custom select dropdown, right? Like there's so much that if you look at the way an operating system handles that component, there's so much that it does that you don't really think about. And there's so much nuance in like every single interaction. And it's different from every browser to browser.
Yeah.
And it's different from one operating system to another. And every browser or device within those operating systems even treats them differently. So, trying to capture all of that nuance would have, I think, been impossible to do without adopting state charts and also introducing a ton of bugs. I think that's truly been one of the most helpful things that we've done in our library to reduce bugs and to catch edge cases is using state charts.
Interesting. Now, so there's so much there that I want to cover. And so I think we're just going to have to kind of like go down the list and cover it all. But I think three things in particular is like what you mentioned about styles, just being unique in not having a strong opinion about styles. You know, we see a lot of like kind of all-in libraries where it's, you know, the opinions are baked in. And so you're just kind of like taking it, using them as is, maybe tweaking them a little bit, but largely borrowing someone else's kind of strongly held opinions. And then kind of the notion that like the core building block of this library is XState and, state machines and state charts.
It's a lot of vocabulary, I know.
There's so much vocabulary.
That was, honestly, when we adopted state charts, that was the biggest struggle for me, was getting all the words right. There's so many. And
well, we should probably cover that then, should, too, because yeah. If you understand it, then we should make sure that everyone else does, too. And then finally, just kind of like the organization of the project, which also feels kind of empowering, like sure. You know, you can just kind of take what you need and whatnot. So I think the first thing is the styling. Something that I'm super fascinated by is just this having to migrate a lot of our like legacy systems to kind of more modern systems in React. I had this little like fear constantly that like the things that we're making now will not stand the test of time.
Sure.
And so the Reach stands out to me as a very fascinating project because it has found the boundaries to not be super opinionated about style and to make the actual like state transitions and all that stuff transcend React itself. So with the styling, tell me a little bit about kind of like where that boundary is for the majority of the components, like what you do export and like how you can kind of the options for customizing it.
Sure. So out of the box, we just write some very basic CSS for all of our components. And when I say basic CSS, I mean we write enough so that the component functions on screen without any changes. So when you fire up our Storybook instance, you are going to see all of our components show up, and they're going to work. And we don't add any additional styles in our testing sandbox to make those work. But we also don't make them pretty, you know, it's like the browser's defaults, the user agent settings, whatnot. It's
sure.
We're basically trying to imagine what user agent would do if we were user agent. And we say, hey, here's this thing, go do with it. And we also don't want it to make it too hard to override what we do give you. So, you know, like a button, if you have a default browser button and you want to make it look like not a browser button, you have to go and override all of these settings in every right. to make sure every browser sort of like cancels out what it's doing by default with a button. And so we're like we try to be user agent, but like less heavy handed, right? So we just literally try to make it work, and the rest is up to you. You know, you can even get rid of our styles completely. Just don't import our style sheets and you don't have anything. And then it's up to you to go and just do everything from scratch. But that's totally fine. So if you want to build a styled component out of our components, you just make it a styled component and do whatever you want with it.
It's an interesting challenge because, you know, because these elements are interactive by default, mm-hmm. You do have to provide something, or else like the documentation would be inscrutable. I imagine, you know, with like dialogues and accordions and all of these kind of things, they would just, everything would be shown or not shown all the time.
Yeah. And the general approach there is, if we do have to give you anything, we just make sure that you can override it if you need to. So even if we're doing, say, inline styles for something, which is, you know, we may do for positioning certain elements on the screen, we will make sure that we are inlining our styles before whatever you would attach to the component would be spread into our style prop, right? So we want to make sure that you have the ability to go in and override our defaults. In most cases, there are some things that obviously you shouldn't override because they're key to maintaining like accessibility or something, and we don't want people to, sure. to go in and make their components inaccessible because that defeats the purpose of what we're building, right? but even accessibility props like the ARIA attributes and roles and tab indexes and those sort of things that we have to take into consideration, even when you follow the ARIA guidelines, we can't predict the context in which our components are going to exist. So just because someone adopts like a menu button, for example, they might put a menu button in, say, the corner of a tab, right? So you've got like a set of tabs, and then in the corner of each of the tabs, there's a nested menu button. So one of the great things about Reach UI being highly composable is that you can do that fairly easily. It's really fairly simple to integrate all of our components with one another and create these really beautiful, complex user interfaces. But the caveat there is that some of those accessibility defaults need to be updated to reflect the context in which you are putting something on the screen. So even though we apply a lot of, you know, accessibility props under the hood, you can't just grab something and go, oh, it's accessible, right? You still need to do your own testing. And depending on the context that these things are built in, you need to make sure that you are doing some other things to supplement what we're doing and override what we're doing in the event that you're using them in a totally, you know, weird context that we haven't predicted. So labeling is another huge thing that I think folks often miss, even when they're working in any sort of HTML or templating environment. You still have to label things, and we have no idea what the label of your menu button is. So you have to tell us. So we can't do everything, but we want to make sure that we're doing enough. And whatever we do, we need to give you the ability to be smarter than us because you know the context of what you're building better than we do. So we need to give you the ability to go in and override what we're doing fairly simply if you need to. And the same thing goes with styles.
Yeah. So one thing that I've really liked in using Reach, especially with like the styles, is that you provide these use data attribute selectors for all the CSS, which is not like super common like across the industry, but something that I am actually a really big fan of, especially kind of having to work between like daily work between, you know, React and non-React systems. The copy pastability of like data attributes into elements like totally far is way superior to like CSS classes because like of freaking class name in
it's like bringing back the ghosts of jQuery now, where it's like add class, remove class, and you end up with like you've got all of these things that are all trying to do their own thing, and they're all just going by class names, and then you have like 30 class names that might conflict with one another. It can be madness if you try to do everything with a class name, right? But also, like, you might have your own, again, this goes back to the design system. If you're trying to build your design system and you are using a CSS in your design system, you have all of your own class names. We're not going to jumble it up with ours, you know, like, if you don't want to use data attributes, then don't use them. You don't have to. But you know, they're there for us because they're all prepended with data reach so that they're specific to, you know, this is a reach data attribute, right? And so like, if you want to change it, it's just change it. You know, like you don't have to worry about removing our class names programmatically and then adding your own class names. It's just less chaos, honestly. And, you know, speaking of state charts and all of this, David Khorshid gave a really great talk at .css in Paris last year, and it was about state adopting the state machine mentality for CSS, which I thought was incredible. And the way that he approaches this is using data attributes. When you have this whole concept, you know, we won't get too deep into state charts because I could talk about that all day too if we had the time. But one of the things I love about just this concept of the finite state machine is that there are a finite number of states that any UI component can be in at any given time. And if you think about it, data attributes are perfect for implementing this in CSS. If you have class names, let's say you have a button. This is a classic example, but you have a button and you have like three button variants, right? And you have class button, class button primary, but then class button secondary. Well, what if you have class button primary and class button secondary applied to your button at the same time?
Yeah.
That's not possible, right? Like you can't have a, unless you're, you know, you adopt some weird thing where your colors just meld and you get some like weird, you know, color, it's like a paintbrush and you've just mixed the two colors. That would be kind of cool, actually.
That'd be sweet, actually.
I'm thinking about it. Somebody needs to build that. That'd be pretty sweet. But nonetheless, in the real world where specificity and order in your style sheets is going to take precedence there, who knows what you end up with, right? And especially in a component system where you might have your CSS being injected in various orders, you know, like that's an impossible state. So if you use data attributes, you could say data color equals an enum of like 10 colors, but you can never have multiple colors, right? So like the idea of using data attributes to prevent impossible states for components is also kind of cool, I think.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I've been kind of taking that approach more and more just in my own work. And I love it because I think it also, it tokenizes like the right part of it, right? Like it tokenizes the enumerable as opposed to like the whole thing. Yeah. Right. And I really love that because then you don't have to do all these like just wild, you know, like BEM style things that nobody can remember all the rules for anyway. It's such a cool way to write styling, I think.
Another really cool benefit, I think, is everyone has their own workflow, but when I'm writing a component, I like to write the markup first. I don't even think about state or I don't worry about state or managing state or changing state or user interactions right away. I think about the markup. And so when I'm scaffolding out a new reach component, I'm writing all of the markup and I'm also writing the data attributes. But then when I'm thinking about what data attributes we're going to use, that helps me very seamlessly transition to thinking about state because you have to think about state to think about which data attributes you're going to use. And then once you write those, it's sort of quick to actually write out all of the state logic because you've got the number of states right there in front of you. You've just written them out in the markup. So it's also a cool side benefit, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's transition into talking about the state charts portion of it, because I think this is really interesting to the programmers who are listening right now. There's a tendency, like if you're writing a React library, to just double down on React, all of the features that are in React for managing state and whatnot. But you've gone like a different direction, which is to do a lot of the logical parts in state charts, and then have just use kind of React as the rendering portion of that. Tell me a little bit about the thinking behind that and what you've seen as like the benefits of that.
Yeah, so I'm really excited about this. And let me just go ahead and say too that I'm pretty new to thinking in state charts. I've like totally bought it and drank the Kool-Aid. Like I'm in there and I love state charts and I love finite state machines and just the whole thing that all of the benefits that come with it, I think, are so tremendous, at least for what I'm building, right? For these UI components, I think it makes so much sense. But I am still new to it, so I'm still learning a lot as I go. And I'm still consulting. I feel like I'm consulting people all the time. It's like, hey, am I actually doing this right? Like, there's certain, like, it's such an old concept, right? And when you hear people talk about it, one of the things they'll say is it's like this old battle-tested thing, this idea of finite state machines. And it gets super in the weeds and very computer science-y. And I am not a computer science person. I don't have a degree.
Oh,
and I literally don't even know how I do my job most days. So the fact that I'm doing this actually sort of amazes me sometimes. But at least understanding the basic concepts of the finite state machines, I think has made a tremendous benefit to how we build our components and how we think about state in reach. And I keep mentioning David, right? Like he built XState. We use XState. David is also a contractor with Reach UI or with React Training, the company behind Reach UI. And so we were working together already on various projects, and he would be in our Slack, and we're always talking and communicating. So if you know David, or even if you just follow him on Twitter, like, that guy will not stop talking about finite state machines. Like, it's literally synonymous with his name at this point. Like, if I were to go on Twitter right now and type anything about finite state machines, David is going to comment within probably 10 minutes or so.
Very tenacious.
I think he's got alerts set up, you know, to go off when someone yeah. tweets about finite state machines. So he's always banging this drum. And so if you work with him, at some point you're going to try using finite state machines for whatever it is you're building. And we did. And it was just, like I said, it was one of those things where as soon as you do it and you start, like, the first time you do it, you're like, what the heck is going on here? Like, the initial gut reaction is you're writing so much more code and you don't really understand why.
Yeah.
Right. Like, if you write a state chart, like, it's very structured and detailed, and it can be a lot. But then once you start running, like, the biggest thing for me, the moment that, like, really sold it for me, I was working on the list box, because that was the first one that I wrote a finite state machine for from scratch. And I was working on the list box. And it's just when you run into some of these edge cases, you start thinking about, like, all of the hoops you have to jump through if you're just writing, like, very imperative JavaScript code to have to deal with some of these edge cases.
Because it's going to be, like, a lot of complex, like, if-else
arrangements. Yeah, complex if-else arrangements. You have to go and, like, create these refs to track, like, certain interactions. And, like, if this interaction took place before this interaction, then we're going to do this. But yeah. if we're not, we're just going to do that, right? But, like, those are the sort of situations where state charts really shine. And when you're building it out initially, there is that initial overhead of, like, oh, this is so much, and I have to think about all of these different things. But then once you start running into the edge cases, it's like fixing those problems is so much simpler. You've already got your different states set up.
Interesting.
And it's just a matter of setting, like, a condition or setting up some sort of action function in your state chart that that checks to see if a certain thing happens in a certain order, right? Like, those sort of fine-tuned pieces of logic become more apparent and easy to write once you already have the state chart built out. So I find working in them from the start has benefits that reveal themselves later on. It's actually a lot like writing in TypeScript, I think, which we also do. And I, when I first started learning TypeScript, it's like, what is this thing and why am I dealing
with it? Like, why is it necessary?
Yeah, like, it's just yelling at me all the time. I don't want that. I just want to build stuff and make it work. But this thing just won't stop yelling at me. And I can't decipher any of its yells. So what am I doing? But then when you have to refactor, like, a hefty application, and now you have type safety, it's like, oh, I get it, right? It's the same idea with state charts, I think.
It's a reduction in your initial coding velocity, but, like, the long-term maintainability of this thing, when you have those bugs, or this is what I'm understanding, is that when you have those bugs creep up that you didn't anticipate when you first wrote the component, there's a place for that instead of just being like, oh, I guess I got to do another nested conditional and, like, consider all the timing aspects of what could or could not have already happened to make this decision.
Yeah, exactly.
So I think I'm definitely not, like, a state charts expert by any means. I have a very, like, shallow understanding of it.
Oh, neither am I.
But I wanted to kind of clarify something with you. Like, the way that I think about them, at least right now, is that, you know, you have use reducer, and that kind of allows you to define, you know, events or, like, actions or whatever, and kind of the resulting state of those things. And that state charts is kind of an additional layer on top of that. You know, so you have let's say, like, use state, which allows you to just change the state directly. Use reducer gives you the language of, like, events. So, like, play, pause, stop.
Sure.
Right? And allows you to change multiple states. Where finite state machines and state charts come in is at the next level, where that actually defines the lines between those states and, like, how, like, what can transition to what is disallowed, etc. Is that an all right way to think about it?
For the most part, I think so. And I think, so you can sort of simplify it by introducing, like, a micro step, right? Like, first of all, I think it's important for people to realize you don't need a library to write in state charts. You can write your own transition functions, which we actually did. Like, I didn't personally do it, but Ryan had written a few in other Reach components before I came on. And he was just using, like, a much simpler, scaled down version of this idea of transitioning between one from one state to another. But The way that I started thinking in state charts, or at least in finite states, was just by using reducers. You don't need really any other additional help or functions. So think of your average model for a reducer in React or using Redux or whatever state management solution you're used to if you're writing reducers. The typical model is you have a switch statement to catch the action type. And depending on the action type, you do something. You change state. You make some sort of adjustments, right? You respond to an action, which in state chart world, or at least in X state, they call events. But it's the same idea, right? You're sending a message somewhere, and that message has some data attached to it. It might respond a certain way if the message reads one way, and it'll respond another way if the message reads another way, right? That's the core idea, is it's just a message with some data, and then your reducer decides what to do with it. So if you write a reducer with this switch statement that just says, based on what action you send me, I'm going to do this thing. Let's say you have two switch statements now, and you have a switch statement above that first checks what is the current state. So, and when I say state, I mean, let's like a specific, like you have a limited number of strings, let's say, and that's your state. So in X state, the state is this enum where you've got, you're only in one state, and then you have additional data that XState calls context. React sort of conflates the two. It has this like state object, right? And when you're working with a reducer, you've got your state, your dispatch. If you want to think in finite states in a very simple way, and you're used to working in reducers, you can just rename some of your variables and start thinking in finite states. You can think instead of calling it state, you can just call it contextual data, or state data, or just like,
okay,
have your state data be something different from state, and think of state as a property on your state data, which is just this enumerated string value, and think of your UI existing in one state at a time. Now in your reducer, instead of just having a switch statement for your action types, you also have a switch statement above that that's checking what your current state is. So think of a traffic light. If a traffic light is red, it can only go from red to green. It can't go from red directly to yellow.
Yeah.
So if your current state is red, in that switch statement, you will check for an action that will send it to green, but there is no action that will send it to yellow. So if your reducer receives an action that would otherwise send it to yellow, it's now caught by that initial switch statement. That is an illegal state transition. And it just... if that were the case, then you would just return whatever your previous state was and do nothing. So now you've got like two guards. Your one guard is saying, what state are you coming from? And then the next guard intercepts the action that then tells it what to do. And if there's nothing there, then it just shoots you out at the end of the reducer and doesn't do anything, right? So like
nothing to see.
So you can't have impossible states now, because you can't move from a red to a green light. You can't go from a green directly to a red either. So you have that yellow light that can only be accessed from green, right? Like green, yellow, or if the power shuts down and now you need to flash yellow, right? Like, so you've got, you can set up all of these edge cases in a state chart. And now in your handlers, your event handlers, you just pass actions. You don't do any conditional checks. You're not like, oh, like when a user mouses down, I need to check, did their mouse move first? Or I need to check like, which thing did they click on? Like, right, you just send that in the dispatch. You just send that as data. And then the state machine handles all of that. Or in this case, a reducer, right? You can do all of this with just a reducer. You don't need anything else, really. Reducers are still great. We still use them. That's how we pass messages. That's how we write our interfaces that talk to the state machine, is we just send off something in a reducer. So we still use React to manage state. We just have state charts to sort of define the logic of our state.
I love that. I think that's a really interesting like point to make too, is that it's not, you're going to be writing this code eventually. And it sounds like what state charts offer you is just a structure that kind of gives you some like a way to discuss these things when they need to be loaded back into your brain again, like your human brain again. That isn't like if something and something else and another thing that are kind of seem unrelated do this thing.
Yeah, it's really like everyone talks about separation of concerns, and you know, everyone has their own meaning for that, right? But like really, when I think of the value of that that way of thinking. I think of like separation of related logic. And so,
yeah.
And again, you can do this without a state chart. You can write a reducer function that, and you can write all of your state in a way where you group this related logic together. That's what hooks are so great at, right? Like hooks are amazing, and it's an addition to the API that allows you to sort of write in related logic versus like when did the thing mount or do a certain thing, right? Like it's you can now think in related logic. State charts provide a very similar benefit in my mind, where you don't have like, again, you just send a message and the state chart deciphers that, and if it's not related to, you know, that particular event, then it just spits you out on the other end and says, yep, just continue doing what you're doing.
So we're kind of like getting a little bit late in here for me to be asking new questions, but I want to kind of talk real quick about the actual structure of Reach. And I think that, you know, it's become more and more popular to have a like a NPM organization and have like little small packages. And that's the way that Reach is structured. So you can just get like the menu button. I'm kind of curious, from a tooling perspective, what are you using to manage that repository with a bunch of packages under one organization?
Yeah, I hate tooling. So like, I don't know if I'm the best or worst person to ask this question, but I try to use the tools that let me do what I actually want to do, is just build components. So like, thankfully, we exist in a time where there are a plethora of really great tools out there. We use Lerna, since it's a monorepo. We use Lerna to sort of manage our launch and dependencies and upgrading and that sort of thing. It's pretty painless. We have some scripts written that just sort of help us not think about that kind of thing.
Cool.
There's some trade-offs. Like I haven't really figured out, and I know that there are answers to these questions, and I'm sure some of your listeners will be able to share those. But you know, I haven't quite yet figured out, once we get to a 1.0, we've sort of decided right now all of the different packages are coupled together in their versioning. And there's not really this, the idea of semver is not there, right? Like we're not, we're just releasing things. So like if we have a batch and there's like one breaking change in one component, like all of the components get updated with it.
Gotcha.
And I haven't quite figured out what the workflow is. Once we get to a 1.0, I think we'll change our approach there. But, you know, we'll get there when we get there. We'll figure it out. But Lerna is still a pretty powerful tool for that sort of thing. We're using TypeScript, which adds a ton of complexity to the build process and for all of the tooling. Thankfully, Jared Palmer wrote a really amazing tool called TSDX, which is just a lifesaver if you're starting any new TypeScript open source package project. Then TSDX is tremendous because it handles all of the integrations with TypeScript and Jest and Babel and Webpack, and you don't have to think about that. And I hate thinking about those things, so it's really, really helpful.
Same.
I did use TSDX initially when we moved from JavaScript to TypeScript, and then once we needed a couple of customizations, I basically it doesn't have like a create React app eject feature, but I sort of did that on my own. I just went and like pulled out all the guts and rewrote what I needed to, but not enough to where I have to think about it very much, because I don't want to have to waste my time doing those sort of things. But those are the two tools that I think we relied on the most.
Nice. Now, when talking about open source and the like the benefits of like a modern open source project, it's hard to separate like successful open source from, I guess, like going back to the LinkedIn part of our conversation, from like kind of being a calling card or like a resume item or whatnot. Mm-hmm. And I know that just recently, you know, unfortunately, React training had to break up and you were looking for new opportunities. How did your work kind of influence that job search? Like your work on this, like, you know, pretty high profile project.
It was invaluable, honestly. Like, you know, everyone has their own story. Everyone has, you know, their own boundaries and what they're able to dedicate their free time to. And I don't want to like disrespect anyone's decision, but honestly, for me, like committing, even if that were a free project, like if I didn't get paid to work on it, let's say, and I just decided, hey, I'm going to be a maintainer of this project and I'm going to reach out to Ryan, I'm going to do this for free and you know, my off time, that would have been worth it, honestly, because I wouldn't say I was very visible in the community before I worked on Reach. And once React training broke up and you know, Ryan tweeted out to his gajillion followers that we were all unemployed. Like, if it weren't for that, you know, getting laid off in this sort of like economic uncertainty would have been super scary, you know?
Yeah.
Like, and I feel so fortunate Like they felt super bad about doing it. And I was like, hey, this honestly, it could not have been a better way to get laid off, because the fact that working on that project made my name something that some people at least recognize already. There are a lot of really like really solid developers and solid teams who are working on projects that use Reach UI, and we have a lot of great contributors, and I'm super fortunate for that. But then to have that that added amplification in that kind of a time was just so useful to me, and it was such a very quick, jarring, but in a good way, adjustment to my career trajectory, I think. And again, if I had to go back and had the opportunity to do it for free, I probably would have done it, because it's been such a help, and it made the job search so much easier, less painful. And it puts you in this position where you now have options, right? Like, I think developers take that for granted so much. Even in tech, like before I was doing this work on Reach, like I was working in agencies and freelancing, and that's like a whole different space that I think there's like this huge disconnect between product people and Silicon Valley developers and like the rest of the world when it comes to tech and agencies, especially. Like those developers are not making six figures, right? Like they're not living these glamorous lives that we see on Twitter or we think about when we think of like big tech salaries, right? Like there's for every one of like us, there's 20 people out there working in an agency who are slinging WordPress sites and they're launching products, and you know, they're just living their lives, doing their thing. And there's that disconnect there. And you know, to have the opportunity to work on something as high profile as Reach UI and with someone as high profile as Ryan and Michael was just such a huge benefit to my prospects moving forward. I couldn't thank those guys enough.
That's awesome. Yeah, I think there's something, I mean, obviously working on a big project like that is amazing, but there's something so valuable about being able to perform your work in a public space, because, you know, when you go to the next thing, it's like, hey, here's my work. You might already be using it or familiar with it. But like, even if you aren't, like you can see it. Like this is like, it's not hidden. Like it's there. If you want to look at it and see if I can do what you need me to do, like it's all there.
Yeah. And when I was going through the interview process, I mean, I had, you know, a handful of folks wanted to give me coding tests, and I was like, dude, like my repo's right here. I've got references who you know, right? Like why do I need this like 10-hour app challenge? Like talk to some people, right? Be a human about it. Like, again, this, are you LinkedIn or are you Twitter? Like, are you human or are you just some robot? Like it's all there, right? And the job that I ultimately took, the interview process was way shorter than what it would have been at a lot of other places. And for me, that's really valuable. I don't have the patience for some of these bigger companies with the rate which they move or the pace at which they move. I mean, it's fine. Like I understand the value in both sides, but like for me, getting to talk to a few folks who were willing to just actually talk to me and look at my work and let it speak for itself, it was super, super helpful. And I don't think I would have had that if it weren't for the work on Reach.
Yeah, well, tell me real quick about your work. What's next? And are you able to take what you've learned from Reach and parlay that into the next thing?
Absolutely. So I just took an offer with Modules. We're building a lot of things. So I don't want to like to misspeak here at any point. So I would just check out Modules, and that's modulz.app. If you want to learn a little bit about Modules, but Modules is many things. One of the things is a component library very similar to Reach. We are building out a large number of components that will ultimately be used in this visual code editor that we're also building. But it's going to enable a lot of teams to create really awesome design systems, a lot like Reach UI does. So very excited about that. Haven't started yet, but it's a great team. They've got a really solid looking product. And yeah, really excited to jump on that.
Killer. Hey, if there's one thing that you're super excited about for like kind of the not near term, but like maybe short term future, like a year to 3 years out, like what are you excited about? What do you think is going to change in web development?
So one of the things that was really cool to me about Modules is that they're building this this low code visual editing tool. And I am just so excited about low code, like that whole movement. There's this So you sort of have low code and no code. And everyone, I don't know, everyone has their own ideas about what's going to win the day. But I think application logic is complex enough that you'll always need the ability to write some code. Mm-hmm. But I think our tooling is still so far behind where we should be in terms of just ease of use, onboarding of new learners, and also just developer experience. Like, even if I can write a bunch of code, do I really want to be staring at a screen all day writing a bunch of code when I could just click a few buttons and get the same result? Yeah. Like, why wouldn't I do that? That's like, think of all the people you can empower to build products if you have tools that make it fun to build products.
Yeah.
And maybe some people like looking at a terminal screen all day, but I mean, I'm not one of them. Like, I don't want to do that. And I'm super excited to see that space explode. I think modules is going to be a key player in that game, and I'm super excited to help build it. But yeah, I'm really bullish on low code and all of the great tools that are going to emerge to empower people to build products.
Killer. Now, you have a great podcast, your Chance the Dev, all over the place. Could you tell me about where people can find you and also hear your smooth, sultry voice?
No one's ever described it that way. But I do appreciate your words, words of affirmation. You can find me at Chance the Dev on Twitter. You can find me at chancethedev.com. You can listen to my podcast, which I am not religious about. I've had some significant gaps in publishing. Not quite the beast mode that Michael Chan is over here, pumping out episodes of React Training or React Podcast. But yeah, no, it's been a lot of fun. And we talk about, I like to focus less on tech and more about the people in tech. And I like to listen to people tell stories and tell the story of their career and how they got involved in tech and, you know, hear about what they want to do. So, those are kinds of things I like to talk about that interest you at all. Then, you know, I'll have some more episodes out pretty soon.
Killer. Well, Chance the Dev, thank you so much for your time today, telling us about Reach and just kind of maintaining a modern open source project. Hope to have you back on soon sometime.
Dude, anytime. Michael's been awesome.
This has been episode 92 of React Podcast with me, Chantastic, and Chance Strickland. Find the people and projects mentioned in this episode at reactpodcast.com/92. Thanks to our sponsor, Infinite Red. If you're stuck in a React or React Native project, tap Infinite Red for help. They'll teach you your way out of whatever problem you face. Visit reactpodcast.infinite.red to start a new project today and get 2 tickets to Chain React Conf in 2021. If you like this show, there's a fast, free way to demonstrate your support. Leave us a review on iTunes. It's the best way for you to let me know what you think we're doing right and what we can improve. 2 to 3 minutes of your time helps us make the best show we possibly can. As always, links and show notes for all episodes are available at reactpodcast.com. This episode was edited by Mikhail Delport. It was produced by Mikhail Delport and Sarah Jackson at Spec, a network to help you level up in design and development. Check out spec.fm for other shows that are sure to fast-track your career. I'm your friend, Chantastic. Thanks for listening. We'll be in your ears again next week.